including your local community radio station, Mindy Rann, Michelle Schuler, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wing Sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm Wing's series producer, Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You are about to cross the border.
Coming up on A Different Nature, it's a preview of this year's March Music Moderne, profiling three free concerts happening at the Community Music Center. Tombeau de Claude Debussy commemorates the passing 100 years ago this month of one of the 20th century's most influential composers. I'm Andy Hosh. Join me along with March Music Moderne's Bob Priest and composers Jeff Winslow and Jennifer Wright on A Different Nature, Monday, March 19th from 8 to 10 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee will meet this month on March 22nd at 4:30.
Good morning. It's 9:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what's coming up today for the morning on KBOO. It's March 16th. And Veterans Voice Radio starts us off this morning. Today, Marvin is flying solo and says he'll probably be taking your calls. At 10 o'clock on Valley Views, it's a conversation with Faith Reidenbach, co-founder of Showing Up for Racial Justice. At 10 o'clock, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Project Censored discusses the Me Too campaign and how corporate media portrays sexual harassment and violence. And we thank you once again, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. Here comes Veterans Voice.
through these fields of destruction. Baptisms of fire, I've witnessed your suffering as the battle reached higher. And though it hurt me so bad, in the fear and the alarm, you did not desert me, my brothers and I.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River, and 104.3 FM Corvallis in Albany. You can hear KBOO on the World Wide Web at KBO.FM. And if you want, you can hear some of our older shows at KBOO.FM/Veterans Voice. I'm Marvin, and Tammy's in the engineer room as usual, and Mike is in Vietnam right now with his daughter. He's at My Lai, for the 50th anniversary of the massacre in My Lai, one of many slaughter of the Vietnamese people during the Americans' war on Vietnam. If you've read Nick Turse's book, Killing Anything That Moves, he really shows you what the war turned into be, you know. And he really has it down where he shows you and backs it up in his book. And it's a book that I really think is good to read and really lets you show what happens, you know, when a army doesn't respect anything, any life or any people's lives, especially children and older people and all that. That's the Killing Anything That Moves by Nick Turse. I've been to My Lai probably 3 times. Angie's doing fine. I talked to Angie this week. She's up in Olympia still. She's doing fine. I like to keep in contact with her because she's my pal. And I miss her when she's not here, but I got Mike, and Mike does very well. But like I was saying, I'd been in My Lai four times. The first one was in 1994, and it was still pretty rustic back then. They had put up the big mural, and then they had the big statue there. But it was still pretty rustic. The ditch that Callie and the troopers threw people in before killing them was still just a ditch. And they had a really nice museum. They had when you went in there, but that time not a lot of people were going to My Lai back in 94. And when you'd go in there, you'd sign in a book, and then they'd bring you tea, a nice pot of tea. And you would talk, and they would ask you questions. And nobody who had survived the massacre at My Lai would be there when Americans were there. They wouldn't come. If they people would always call out there and say there's some Americans on the way, and people would leave. But now they don't. Now they stay there, and people talk to the people who survived, and it's really really different. But after you would drink the tea, and they would show you to this museum, and there's on one wall there's a huge wall that has all the names of the people that were murdered at My Lai, and it goes from children less than a year old to people in their 80s, and that wall is just full. The 504 names are on that wall, and they did. The troops were in My Lai. They weren't there any longer than maybe 4 hours, and they killed 504 people in that four-hour period. And you know how many Americans were killed that day? None. One guy shot himself in the foot, and that was his own fault. He shot himself in the foot. But there was nobody there. What we're going to talk a little about this too, and then I'm going to talk about toxic war, the story of Agent Orange in Vietnam, and that's really a tough one to deal with also. But you know, 1968 was Tammy and I were talking a little bit about it before we really started. That was really a tough year, 1968, you know. I was in Vietnam in 1968, and it was really a tough year. And also here, it was a tough year, you know. 1968 was the biggest Tet offensive. You know, Tet is the holiday in Vietnam where everybody goes home and you know, parties and has a good time, and there'd always been a ceasefire, and the North and the Viet Cong had a ceasefire and with the people in the South, but that didn't work out because the North and the Viet Cong attacked every major city in South Vietnam, and it was pretty, you know, it was a bad battle. And the city of Hue, which is the old imperial capital of Vietnam, was completely annihilated. The Battle of Hue lasted longer than any of the others during that time period. And if you go there now, you can't really see anything about the battle. The city's been built back. Even the citadel, where the Viet Cong actually were during the fighting, and it's been all repaired. There's some things there that haven't been repaired, but most of it has been repaired. And so you really can't tell that much of the battle. In 1994, when Laurel was teaching at the university in Hue, I would travel around the city and try to, you know, see stuff about the war. And in 94, you could do that, but after that, you really couldn't really see anything. I used to go to this one building, a two-story building. This is right on the waterfront by the college. There was this one window that had bullet holes all around the window, and where somebody was, you know, being a sniper, and they were trying to get him. And it had been all patched up, and you can't even see it. You know, there's nothing there. You can't really see it. There's a couple of museums, a really nice Ho Chi Minh Museum there that you can go to, and it's really nice. And but there's not really much of the war there. It's gone. I mean, they got a four-star hotel in Hue, and boy, it's expensive. Like, it's really expensive. But there's not much in Hue. And during that time, 1968, one of my heroes, Dr. Martin Luther King, was murdered. And then not long after that, Bobby Kennedy, who was running for president, was murdered. And, you know, I've talked about this before, where we really, you know, us guys over there, you know, we were rooting for Bobby to win, you know, because Bobby was going to end the war. And like I've said before, you know, wouldn't do us guys there any good, but, it would help our younger brothers and cousins and stuff, you know. And so we were all rooting for Bobby. And then the police riots in Chicago at the Democratic Convention was pretty terrible. So those two, just a couple of the horrible things that went on that year. There's a lot more than that, but those are some of them. And in Vietnam, that was the worst year for America in the whole war. It was the worst year for American dead. In that year, there were 16,899 Americans killed in the war, and that's the most of any of the time there. And if there was that many of us guys killed, you can imagine how many Vietnamese were killed. I mean, there was the bombings, you know, the artillery fire, everything, you know. Got those people in Vietnam, you know, they were living every day by their fingertips, you know, they were just trying to hold on. And especially in the countryside, where, you know, you really couldn't tell who was who, and you just had to be really, really careful. But the Charlie Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Infantry Regiment, 11th Infantry Brigade, Americal Division, had only been in Vietnam since December of 1967, and so they hadn't been in country that long. They hadn't been that experienced as infantry units. It's right after they got there, the Tet Offensive had started, and by that time, between January of 1968 until March of 1968, they had lost 40 of their brothers in combat there. And when the decision was made to go into My Lai, My Lai is a community. There was all these little hamlets, little villages and stuff all around that area. And so when people talk about My Lai, it wasn't just the one My Lai. There was other places. Now I'll talk about a little bit about that. But they called it Pinkville because they said it was, everybody there was a sympathizer to the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese soldiers. So they called it Pinkville. And so they were told by their commanders that they were going to go into Pinkville. And they said by 7 o'clock in the morning, everybody would be out of the village to the market to get food. And anybody behind was Viet Cong or a sympathizer. And they ask it's really conflict. Some of the guys that were there say one thing, some of the guys say the other thing. Ernest Medina was the company commander of Charlie Company, and the night before they go out, they tell you what you're going to do and all that, and that he told, some of them say he told the troops that by 7 o'clock they'd all be out. Anybody left would be a Viet Cong. And they said that when you go in there, kill all combatants and burn the village down. Kill all suspects, men, women, children, animals. And some of the guys say, well, he didn't say that. And some of them said that he did say that. And that's kind of but they did go in there and they did kill everybody. And there's only one person that really got anything done to him, and that was Lieutenant Callie. And William Callie was a second lieutenant. He wasn't a very good officer. He should never have been an officer. The only reason he became an officer is because he had some credits. He'd gone to like maybe a year of college, and they put him through officer's candidate school. The guy could barely read a map, and they put him in charge. And they wanted him to be they put him into the as a platoon leader in I think second platoon. But when they went into My Lai that morning, there was about 100 troopers that were brought in, and as they landed, they got off the helicopter and they started walking through the village, and everything was pretty quiet. And people were surprised that there were that many people in the village. And the people were having breakfast, and some of them were in front of a pagoda having prayers. And as they started walking in, they don't know who it was, but one guy started bayoneting people with his bayonet. He started killing people with his bayonet. And as soon as he did that, the whole thing erupted, people started shooting people, and the people who were in front of the pagoda, there was about 20 of them, they were all shot and killed at point blank range. There were women and children that did that. Things got really out of control. Everything just went crazy, and that's when they just started shooting everybody. They would throw hand grenades into hooches. They would bring everybody out, and they were just shooting everybody, animals, children, old people, old men and women, young people, and the guys some of the guys that were interviewed about what went on in My Lai. They said there was a lot of rape, lots of rape, that they raped the women and the girls, and then they would shoot them. Cali, Lieutenant Cali ordered the troopers to put people in that ditch I was talking about, and then they shot them point blank range in this ditch that was an irrigation ditch, basically what it was. And they were, one of the guys, Private, I think it's Midlo. He said, "I'm not going to do it." And Cali threatened him. He says, "If you don't do it, I'm going to charge you and you'll go to prison for disobeying a direct order." And so the kid did it, and Cali did it too at the same time. So they killed about, at that time, I think between 25 and 50 people right at that time. And that they stopped for lunch, of all things. They stopped and had their lunch. And then it started up again after they had their lunch. It started again. Some people got out and got away, but not very many of them. And one of the big heroes of that whole mess was a warrant officer, Hugh Thompson, who was a helicopter pilot. And he saw what was happening, and so he brought his helicopter down. He told the two door gunners that if those Americans didn't stop killing people, they were to open up on the American troops. And they stopped. And he got a warrant officer called Mr. Thompson went up and he talked to Cali. And he told him that this isn't right. This is murder. You can't do this anymore. And Cali told him, "You can do whatever you want in the sky, but down here on the ground, I'm the boss." And those door gunners and Mr. Thompson stopped them from doing quite a bit. They got quite a few people out, but of the three people, all three of those guys on that helicopter are now passed away. Mr. Thompson, he died, and Larry Colburn, he died, and then the other guy, Glenn Andrew, I think his name was Andrew Teddy, something like, and he was killed a few weeks later in another operation. He was killed, but he, they did a wonderful thing. And so when Mr. Thompson landed his helicopter, one of the guys got out and ran to that ditch, and he pulled out a child that was still alive in that ditch, and put him on the helicopter, and the helicopter took off, and then they came back, and two other helicopters came, and Mr. Thompson loaded that with a lot of people to get him out of there. And Mr. Thompson went and told, as he was going back, he went and told his commander what was going on. And then all of a sudden, everything stopped. You know, the company commander told everybody to stop firing. And he's the one that actually told them to do it, you know. The captain told him, you know, he's the one that really actually told him. And he said he didn't get in any trouble. The only person that got in any trouble was Lieutenant Cali. And he went on trial. And the American people, you know, said that, oh, those guys were just doing their job. It was a war. And Cali got some kind of a sentence, but Nixon pardoned him. And so he got away with that murder too, with the murdering all those guys. And the captain, Medina, nothing happened to him. And the colonel, battalion colonel, he got a letter of reprimand. That's all he got, was a letter of reprimand. And 504 innocent people died, were murdered that day. And, when finally that came out, it took a couple of years before it came out, but this is a name you'll recognize, Colin Powell. Colin Powell was a colonel in the AmeriCal, and he was ordered to investigate what happened at My Lai. And he wrote, in direct retribution of this portrayal is the fact that relationships between AmeriCal division soldiers and the Vietnamese people are excellent. He said there was no trouble between the Vietnamese and the AmeriCal soldiers. You know, it was good, nothing wrong. But everybody said that Colin Powell whitewashed the atrocities of My Lai, that he definitely tried to cover. He covered it up, and he whitewashed the, all this murdering that went on. I want to thank KBOO members for your support. And to keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. And Tammy, you want to go ahead and play that second song?
We bomb everywhere, man. We bomb everywhere. Way more than our share, man. We bomb everywhere. We bomb the mountains bare, man. Found the desert air. Oh boy, don't we care, man. Cause we bomb everywhere. We've bombed in Peru, Panama, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Laos, Syria, Sudan, Congo, Cuba, Korea, Kuwait, Colombia, Cambodia. Ain't we great? Grenada, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Vietnam, Yugoslavia, El Salvador, Afghanistan, Japan, Bosnia, Somalia, Indonesia, Iraq, China, Iran. Time to attack, yeah, we bomb everywhere. Way more than our share. Don't think we ain't fair, cause we'll bomb everywhere. We got family values and moral majority, peace, love, Jesus, top priority. Do unto them for they do unto us, the kingdom come in nuclear dust. Well, monumental profits are being made for the big shareholders in the old arms trade. They lust for the dust of a mushroom cloud. It's making them all American proud. Yeah, heat seeker, bunker buster, daisy cutter, napalm, phosphorus, uranium, smart bomb, A-bomb, predator, prowler, raptor, raven, tomahawk, hellfire, flags are waving. We bomb everywhere, way more than our share. Oh boy, ain't we fair, cause we'll bomb everywhere. Our vision of peace has become a ghost, but we're number one, we bomb the most. Soldiers coming home suicidal, we sit and watch American Idol, Saudi, Serbia, Mexico, Kosovo, Romania, Germany, load them up, here we go, another verse. Life gets worse, just watch your show and wait for the glow. Well, someday soon we'll all have nukes, true world democracy. Extermination of all life, high possibility. Well, ask your child what they suggest to prevent mass destruction and bring this world in line with love and a brotherhood connection. De-escalate your mental state, incinerate your tools of fate. Build no more weapons or rejuvenate our planet's fate. Drop food, medicine, clothes, and tools the children wish you'd see. That will win most the hearts and minds before you count to three. Then we'll roam everywhere, man, way more than our share. Don't think we ain't fair, man, cause we'll bomb everywhere. We'll bomb in Peru, Panama, Pakistan, Yemen, Libya, Laos, Syria, Sudan, Congo, Cuba, Korea, Kuwait, Colombia, Cambodia. Ain't we great? Grenada, Nicaragua, Guatemala, Vietnam, Yugoslavia, El Salvador, Afghanistan, Japan, Bosnia, Somalia, Indonesia, Iraq, China, Iran. Time to attack.
Yeah, that's a really... good song, interesting song. The song that we started the show out with is Dire Straits, and it's from their album Brothers in Arms. And the very last song on that CD that I have is called Brothers in Arms, and that's the name of the song that I started out with today. And I thought it was pretty, it would be a good song. I tried to find my Tracy Chapman Revolution, talking about a revolution, I don't know where I put it. And then I tried to find my Bob Dylan Masters of War, and I don't know where I put it. but I thought these two were pretty good. And Tammy, can you get the name of that? It's We Bomb Everywhere.
Right, and it's written right here on the disc. It says it's by Marcus Jones, and he's a local guy, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And it says here his email address, so I assume people can go to it. It's jonesman1012@q.com.
Yeah, so that's a real good. That's We Bomb Everywhere.
Love and that song.
Yeah, it's a great song.
Oh, so stirring.
I came one day and looked in my little box out front, and there it was, you know, and he said, play this anytime you want, you know, and so I do a lot. But I want to get back to Milai. I mean, it was when that was going on, I was up in the Central Highlands, and during the Tet, after Tet, it was just horrible. I mean, it was just like a free fire. Everything was going crazy, you know, and we're just trying to stay alive. But there wasn't any of the slaughter like they did at Milai. I mean, not only did they kill 504 people, they also burned down all the hooches. They killed one man and threw him in the well, and then threw hand grenades in after that. They raped the women and the children. And if you really want to hear about it, go on YouTube and put in Milai. And there's about three or four interviews with guys that were there. And look at the way they talk about it. You know, it was just like fact, 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 you know. There's really no emotion, and two of them are white dudes. And one of them says, I didn't fire around, you know, during that. But there's one guy, this African-American guy, and it affected him so much. This poor guy, he shakes all the time. He almost cries when he talks about it. In fact, he does cry about what he did in Milai. He made a scrapbook of stories about Milai and the horrible, horrible pictures of Milai. He is in such bad shape. They were saying that he doesn't get out very much. He stays at home, and he's just shaky. He's just really shaky. And they say that that suicides were pretty high in Charlie Company after the war. That a lot of guys had killed themselves after the war, and one guy did go back to Vietnam that had been at Milai. He went to Milai, and one of the survivors asked him, you know, he didn't know the survivor, didn't know. He says, what'd you do in the war? And he says, I was here in Milai. And the guy, I mean, it was just so hard that the American guy, he left. He went back home. He didn't stay around. And the Vietnamese guy, the next day, they talked to him, and he said, last night I did nothing but drink alcohol all night long. He says, I didn't get to tell him how I really feel, you know, about them killing my family. And that's pretty telling, you know, that, you know, when you've looked that murder fate in the eyes, you know, murder in the eyes, it's pretty tough. And you know, it's pretty horrible what they did at Milai. And when Mike comes back, our next show, we'll have Mike talk about what went on that day, the 50th anniversary. I know it's going to be really a big deal. And some of my friends, Chuck Searcy's going to be there, I know, and probably Lady Borton. and a few of the folks from Hanoi will be there. Even Lonnie, my daughter, she sent me a thing last night, a 50th anniversary, and I told her, I said, it's a sad day, and I'm very sad, and she says, I know. So, but it's pretty horrible. And also, I've been keeping up on the young woman in Palestine, Ahad Tamimi, the young Palestinian girl who's on trial for assaulting a Israeli Defense Force fully armed soldier with weapons and everything. And she's on trial for assaulting him with her fists, her little fists, you know. She's a brave girl. She's a brave, brave girl. If you want to see and hear stuff about her, you can also go on Facebook and put her name in, T-A-M-I-M-I. Her first name, A-H-A-D, and her last name, T-A-M-I-M-I, and you can see her. They're doing her trial behind closed doors. They're not gonna let the news people in. And her family has been fighting to save their home and their land since 1948. I'm pretty sure. So she's really a brave girl, and I'm gonna keep, you know, looking and seeing how she's doing, being brave. If you see what these kids are, just kids trying to protect themselves. There's pictures of these IDF soldiers, you know, grabbing these kids, and these kids trying to get away from them, and you know, trying to pull their friends away out of the grasp of these guys' hands. And these kids, what they got, their fists and rocks and sticks. Against somebody that's got a fully automatic, probably an American M16 rifle. These children, these poor children, you know. It's not very good what's going on. I have a book that I'm reading. It's called Toxic War, The Story of Agent Orange by Peter Sills. And we've talked about Agent Orange before, and I've read a lot about it because I have problems from Agent Orange, and most of my friends do too. And this just really explains a lot of things, you know. One of the things that it really, really talks about of this Agent Orange is the how far back they knew, these chemical companies knew there was a problem with these defoliants, these kill the vegetation, basically, but they also were making them so they could kill crops. They would kill the rice, the rice crops, the mangoes, anything that was being grown. The American government came out and said, we only spray stuff on, Viet Cong stuff. And which turned out to be a big lie. And I didn't know this about it either, that when they would spray this stuff, that it could drift up to 30 miles away. So if they're doing it here, it could drift 30 miles or more, depending on the wind, before it went down on other crops that, you know. And people were getting really, really sick, and the American government came up with a thing to pay them, you know, like you can pay somebody for contaminating their ground, where it was in the fish, it was in the water supply, it was in the root vegetables supply, it was everywhere. They did it everywhere, and they dropped so much, sprayed so much. They were doing it a couple ways. One was they were using these C-123, these older airplanes, and they fixed them up so that they would they could spray. They'd be like three or four, you know, side by side flying over a certain area. And the thing that the would sometimes get them to go that they would be shot at, and so they couldn't fly low anymore. They had to fly higher, and that made it the chances even worse of getting Agent Orange on. There wasn't just Agent Orange. There was Agent White, Agent Purple, Agent Blue, I think Blue, or and then Agent Orange. And I didn't know. I thought that by putting the chemicals together, it's what made the dioxin. And dioxin is deadly. It's just deadly. And come to find out, when they would mix their chemicals in, they would have to heat them. And if they heated them up to 160 degrees Fahrenheit, that it wouldn't make as much dioxin, but it still had some dioxin. Anything up to past that, up to 165 degrees, dioxin, the byproduct was dioxin. And they would try to, you know, filter that out and everything, but they never really could do it. And the dioxin is what really, really is the dangerous thing, that it caused illnesses, it caused cancers in people over there, it caused birth defects in people over there. It caused just the land to be just no good. And they were trying to say, well, some of that stuff only lasts 2 or 3 days or whatever, and which turned out to be a lie also. And they tried to, you know, pass that on to people. And then they said, well, you know, it's the Viet Cong's fault. You know, they're spreading all these lies about this deadly chemicals we're spraying on them. It turned out to be they were right, that it was a deadly chemical. And the other ways that it would be sprayed would be by helicopters. They would have helicopters with nozzles on them, and they would spray it that way. The other way would be to have a backpack, and guys would have a backpack and go around the perimeters of their camps and all of that and spray it that way. And they were saying in this book that the guys in these base camps got it really worse than the guys out in the field, because they were being sprayed over and over and over again, where usually in the field they would spray one area and wouldn't hit it again, you know, maybe never, or maybe, you know, a year later, 2 years later, whatever. But these guys on these base camps would have to keep the, you know, the foliage away from their perimeter so they could, you know, see out and wouldn't give the VC a place to hide and to attack them. But it didn't seem to matter that they would do this, because the VC fought at night. You know, they traveled at night. The NVA traveled most of the time at night. And so it really didn't matter that they were doing this. It was just, you know, it was killing off the food crops and making everybody sick. They would try to, it was called Ranch Hand, was the unit that was spraying all the dioxins. And they were trying to, these guys, some of them believed it was true. And they would try to prove to the Vietnamese that nothing wrong with it. They would drink some of it, or they would wash their hands with it. And the guys that really, really got it bad were the guys that took the defoliants out of the cans and put them in the airplanes, because they would always leak and pour. They said that the nozzles on the airplanes would leak and drip all over the place. If the tank was clogged, they would get the smallest guy, put him inside, he'd go in and clean it up and put new gaskets in it, because the defoliants would eat away the rubber gaskets. And these guys really got it. And so also they were saying that when they would finish with these 55-gallon drums, they would just set them aside, and people would use them. The military guys would cut them in half. And they said between 1 and 3 gallons of defoliant, Agent Orange or white or purple or whatever, was still in it. You know, so they'd dump that out on the ground, and they'd cut a barrel in half and make a barbecue thing. Or the Vietnamese would get it, and they would put gasoline in it, and that would just make the dioxins worse. And they would sell this gas out of it to cars in the cities, and they were noticing that there wasn't very much greenery in the cities anymore, because the gasoline with the dioxin in it would get heated up and these come out the tailpipe and land on people and they were killing off all the green. And so the decision was made that they would have to punch holes in the tops and bottoms of these 55 gallon barrels so the people wouldn't use them. And they talked about how if they were on a mission, these planes, the C-123s, were on missions, that if they couldn't do their spraying, they would just drop the whole load before they landed back at their base. So they didn't care where they dropped it. You know, a whole load down, just bam, down on the ground. You know, they didn't really care. And they knew, like I said, they knew back in the 50s and the 60s that this stuff was poison. And they never let it out at all. One of the only diseases that for children here in our country, for Agent Orange, is spina bifida. That these children that are born from veterans, non-veterans, with spina bifida, is considered service-connected from Agent Orange. And those children couldn't be taken care of. There was a large amount of women, wives, not being able to carry their babies full term. And the women nurses and clerks couldn't get pregnant. And if they did get pregnant, they couldn't carry their children to full term. You know, it just depended on the person, and that's a real problem too. And one of the biggest problems that they were having with these dioxins was chloracne, and chloracne is caused by the dioxins. It's horrible dioxins in their plants where they were making these plants. We're making these dioxins. Their workers came down with chloracne, and it just looks like rashes, just horrible rashes with bumps and everything that would, you know, cover their bodies. And they were saying that, well, you know, none of the women got sick, and the reason none of the women got sick because there was no women working in the plants working on these dioxins, and so that was a real problem there. And some of the other problems that they were having, like I was talking about, was the drift from this. It just makes me so angry. And one of the things with the males, us guys, it takes a while for the dioxin in your body sometimes because it goes into your fatty tissues in your body, and one of the places that it goes through is your liver, and your liver can't get this dioxin out of your body. And so guys will non-vets are getting liver cancer. They're getting their livers are becoming big, you know, fatty livers. It's in our fatty tissues. So if someone loses a lot of weight, it gets back in their system, and you can get cancers, just different kinds of cancers, these weird cancers that guys are getting. And one of the things that they're not really talking about, but they're testing, and that is sperm, non-vet sperm. I took an Agent Orange test, and they up on the hill at the Veterans Hospital, and they sent me down to a clinic down on the waterfront over by the new bridge now that's down there. And I walked in there and gave her my papers, and she says, another Vietnam vet. And I said, what do you mean? She says, they're sending us a lot of Vietnam vets to have their sperm tested. There's a lot of Iraqi vets that are getting their sperm tested. And so that's something they're working on now, but who knows, you know, what become of that. What it does, it makes our sperm deformed, and you can't conceive. And so I remember that my wife, my first wife, I've been married a few times, my first wife couldn't get pregnant. She would get pregnant and then lose it. You know, that happened two or three times. But then she finally did get pregnant and carried Brandon for the full 9 months, and then tried to have another child and couldn't get pregnant again. Couldn't get pregnant. Same thing was happening. And to find out that through these testing, that my sperm was deformed. And so that happened to a lot of, that nurse down there says, that's what they're finding, that it's happening to a lot of you guys. So it all depends on where you were in Vietnam. If you were in a heavy area that was sprayed a lot, and if you got sprayed, but if you're in a base camp, you got it. There was no safe place. Down on the down in the Mekong Delta, they sprayed the sides of the river and the streams down there constantly to get the butchers back away from the sides, so these river gunboats could go up and down those rivers. And so not only were the guys on the ships doing that, but the people living on the living around those areas that were being sprayed. So it was just a horrible time. And I know this sounds, you know, this is really not a good day, and I'm sorry that, you know, but I thought it was important that we talked about this. The book that my brothers and sister non-vets should read is called Toxic War, The Story of Agent Orange by Peter Sills. We'll be back Friday, April 20th at 9 a.m., and there it is.
Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in a thousand different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it? For I flew the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming, well,
and they close the missile plant. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore.
Makes a positive difference in all our lives. Thank you for supporting this effort to keep Portland vital and engaged. Thank you for keeping Portland radical, and thank you for supporting KBOO.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for keeping KBOO fierce, vital, and independent, accountable to no one but you, the community.
Happy birthday!
The Oregon Historical Society is featuring 50 years of KBOO. The exhibit was created to relay our history and demonstrate the importance of community radio, featuring archival photographs and ephemera collected from KBOO's 5 decades of broadcasting. The exhibit tells our story in our members' own collective words. Our online tour features highlights from the exhibit and companion audio clips to enrich visitors' experiences. The exhibit runs until July 29th at the Oregon Historical Society at 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information and audio clips can be found at 50yearsofkboo.fm.
And this is KBOO Portland. It has just turned 10:01 a.m., which means it's time for Valley Views, featuring a conversation with Faith Reidenbach, co-founder of Showing Up for Racial Justice. We're going to follow that with Flashpoints and round out the morning at 11 with Project Censored discussing the Me Too campaign.